Greetings, everyone. Welcome to Crown Enclosure. I'm your host, Patrick Brown. When it comes to the calendar year, we've reached that point where it's out with the old and in with the new. So for this episode, we're doing a double take, glancing back at some of the biggest stories from the world of church, state, and faithful citizenship from 2022, and also casting our gaze forward at issues and trends that will shape much of what's in store for 2023. We touch on everything from the lifting of COVID restrictions and reflecting on lasting effects that they may have on how we worship. Pope Francis's visit to Canada, the recent passing of Pope Benedict XVI, rising violence against Catholic churches, and what to expect from the next phases of major initiatives within the church, including the National Eucharistic Revival in America and the Synodal Way in Germany. Our guest is popular Catholic commentator, speaker, and writer Brian Holdsworth. On his widely followed YouTube channel, Brian provides regular reflections on the major challenges facing Catholics and the beauty of the church's tradition and history. Be sure to look him up online and check out his videos. As we kick off a new year, we want to sincerely thank all of our listeners for tuning into Crown Enclosure. We're immensely grateful. If your New Year's resolutions include lending support to up-and-coming Catholic podcasts aiming to help sanctify the public square, visit our website at www.crownenclosure.com to learn more about the many ways you can partner with us.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant. At God's first.
Brian Holdsworth, welcome to Crown Enclosure.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, today we're going to do a bit of a double take. We're going to look in the rearview mirror to 2022 and cast our glance forward to 2023, looking at some of the major issues and trends in the life of the church. I think where I want to start, we're recording this in early January 2023. Can you take yourself back to early January 2022? And just tell me what kind of state of mind you were in, and fast forwarding today, any contrast you might draw since the previous year has elapsed.
Well, ironically, you're asking more from me than I think I'm actually capable of. I have a tough time remembering what I did yesterday. Like, life just seems to happen at such a fast pace in this season of life. But I mean, there are some things that stand out to me more on a personal level, though, than a sort of like a global or a political or a current events type level. So where I am, there were still pretty severe mandates and restrictions. We couldn't all attend church without registering, and we would often run out of spots to register for. We couldn't stay inside and meet and visit with people. So one of the really beautiful things that happened quite organically and in a very Canadiana way in my parish was there's a park across the street from our church, and it also has a hockey rink there. And then sort of external to that hockey rink, more of a casual ice that's flooded on the field there. And many of us started bringing our skates and our sticks and our pucks. And we just organically, spontaneously developed a tradition of, well, if we can't meet inside, let's meet outside. People would bring thermoses and coffee and hot chocolate and things like that. And we would head out onto the ice and play for hours. And that satisfied and fulfilled like a pretty serious need. I think that everybody was experiencing, but we certainly were. Especially because, I mean, it's one thing to be lonely. It's another thing to be lonely with arm's length access to the thing that will fix that loneliness, right? It's sort of like being starving and having just a banquet right out of reach from you. And that's what it felt like with our community. We have just this beautiful, rich Catholic church community here in Edmonton. And we would see each other from 6 feet apart in pews and things like that. But then we would be ushered out of the church immediately after Mass. And it just felt like there's got to be ways around this, you know? Like, we're not, if these mandates weren't in place, we wouldn't be exercising these kinds of recommendations. But for us, you know, we were trying to do our best as citizens to respect our civic government, but also, you know, our bishop's provisions and rules that were in place. And so we left the church, but then outside, even in the freezing cold, we would gather and show our appreciation for each other and our need for community. And it was a beautiful time. But also, you know, there was an underlying anxiety and concern for when is this going to end, and also a bit of scandal in how the church was handling it and not really exercising its own unique moral authority, just kind of lobbing that off or pitching that off to health authorities who aren't ethicists, who can only tell us, you know, the science, but they can't tell us what we ought to do in light of that knowledge. That's up to ethicists. That's up to those with moral authority, which the church has, and the church didn't really seem to want to exercise.
Here on our program, we've done a couple of episodes over the past few years on COVID restrictions and how to interpret them in light of Catholic just law tradition and the obligations on the part of Catholic citizens in terms of responding them or challenging them or engaging in legitimate civil disobedience and the like. With the restrictions now having been lifted, and certainly I live in the province of Ontario, what you were describing in the early situation of 2022, that was very much the situation here, perhaps more so. A question that that we've been grappling with at Crown and Crozier, and that's been on my mind personally, is in light of this experience, what do we do? I mean, how do we interpret this? How do we make sense of what just happened, including how our church responded to this scenario? And how does it inform lessons learned and going forward?
It's tough for me because temperament-wise, I'm pretty scrappy. I'm the kind of person who doesn't tend to back down from fights. And that has not served me well. I'm not trying to say that that's a virtue. I've often gotten myself into situations, especially when I was younger as a teenager, that I couldn't really actually fight my way out of because I'm not a big guy. I have a big mouth, but I'm not a big guy. Hence the YouTube channel. but, you know, there are times in which obedience is the way to go, whether we like it or not, and even whether it's the direction that we're being given is the best prudential judgments, right? Because a lot of what happened during the pandemic wasn't something where you could just appeal to a scripture verse or something in the catechism or a dogma. A lot of this was unprecedented. We didn't know what we were dealing with. And so a lot of it just came down to, okay, here's the facts that we think we have. We're going to weigh them according to certain principles and then make prudential judgments based on that. And I would say there were a lot of bad prudential judgments that have been made. But nonetheless, it would be better to make those bad decisions under the direction of a legitimate authority like your bishop than it would be to have made your own prudential judgments that were right out of disobedience for your bishop. It produces humility. It produces good for the church and for the community and for the dynamic of what it means to be under someone's authority, which we all are in the case of, you know, lay people and a bishop, as well as other dimensions of life. The other can produce pride, self-righteousness, and disobedience itself is just, that's not a virtue. That's not a good that we recognize as Catholics. So I think that does need to be, to whatever degree it's reasonable, the name of the game is to submit ourselves to that and to endure certain kinds of sufferings if it's necessary as a result of perhaps bad prudential decisions, but also recognizing where the limits of that authority extends, right? And that's maybe a little bit harder to judge, but I would say that, you know, insofar as we attend Mass and those buildings and those structures and the liturgy are governed by legitimate ecclesiastical authorities, they don't also extend to, let's say, the nuances of your domestic life, right? So if there are mandates in place by health authorities who say you're not allowed to have company over, you're not allowed to take certain reasonable risks of infection of a disease that isn't necessarily dangerous to you if you're in your 20s or 30s, or it's likely not based on the odds or the chances, those authorities don't have the right to say you can't have company. You can't visit with your relatives, your extended family, your good friends, your community. And if they are true health authorities, they should also recognize the unintended potential consequences of just strictly having a one-dimensional view of a crisis like that, as in don't get infected by a virus that's out there at all costs. Well, what about the economic consequences of that policy? What about the psychological consequences of that policy? What about the development of my children and the negative consequences that comes along with something like that? Those kinds of things they didn't seem to want to address, and therefore I think were worthy of being questioned and and perhaps even disobeyed in certain respects. To try to summarize what was a bit of a ramble there, I don't think bishops have the authority to tell you exactly how to arrange your domestic life in very detailed, nuanced ways. Certainly when it comes to faith and morals, they do to a certain degree out of principle. But if they were doing that, I think that you have some legitimate grounds to say, you know, this is where my authority begins and yours ends. And then I think to whatever degree we can, out of principles like subsidiarity, to focus our attention more local. I think that it was really unhealthy for a lot of us to become preoccupied with the big picture of something that was so massive and so historical as this pandemic was, when it was affecting us locally. And that should have been enough of a responsibility and enough of an anxiety and a stress for most of us to not want to then try to solve all the problems that are going out in government and global affairs and the global church. I think that we need to try to keep our scope limited, not let the scope of what the crystal ball of social media add extra dimensions to this that make it way too hard psychologically and spiritually to carry. And then as we focus locally, I mean, yeah, maybe you can't do things about the Vatican's policy of mandated vaccines or something like that, but maybe there are things that you can do about the way that your parish is organizing. And in the case of our parish, there were some things we could control and there were some things that we couldn't. The things that we could control, like going to the park across the street after Mass every Sunday, that was a way of coping. That was a way of being the church and even actually being a witness. It was quite the scene to see people in three-piece suits, you know, playing pickup hockey with their toques on. And sure. People, as they were walking by, would they were turning their heads, what is going on here? Is this like a movie set? Like this isn't the kind of thing you see every day. And that tradition carried on all through the summer, even as mandates lifted. We now just go to the playground in the park. And now that it's winter again, we're going to start playing hockey again. But people would be out walking their dogs. They'd be out at the playground. They'd be walking by. They'd be driving by. And everybody would turn their heads because we're such a scene to look at. And I love that kind of witness in the church. You know, just inspire people's curiosity, break down some of their prejudices and what they think they know Catholicism to be. And make a mess in... I think when Pope Francis talks about making a mess, I think that is the best interpretation that we can make of it, right? Make a scene that inspires people to go, wow, what's going on over there? That's different. That's new. And it's something that I don't have in my life. And that's kind of attractive.
We can analyze and do a postmortem ad nauseum on the pandemic and the restrictions and their effects and relative justifiability and the like. I think a couple of things... that really continue to gnaw at me, kind of going back to that theme of what's within our control, within our purview, and what isn't. I can't help but feel like there were aspects of the response on the church's part where there was acquiescence to to overreach by civil authorities. And in particular, I mean, I think of, I don't know if it was a thing or a risk out in Western Canada, but in Central Canada and Eastern Canada, there were some places where there was either the specter of having to flash your vax passport to get into the church doors and receive the sacraments, or there was in places in Quebec and New Brunswick, I mean, they actually imposed those rules. And I remember also along those lines, hearing about public health authorities in the city of Toronto that were issuing guidance to houses of worship about how to administer communion and how to pass around the collection basket and the like. And I'll be honest, I mean, those struck me as gross instances of overreach. And what gnaws at me is, again, I don't know how we're making sense of that, or I don't know how we're interpreting that or analyzing that after the fact. And that does cause me concern. I feel like we're kind of left hanging in this post-restriction limbo. And I'm concerned that not tackling that stuff head on and making a good faith assessment of, okay, this happened, this is how we responded, this was good, this wasn't, here's how we're going to move forward. I feel like there's an absence to that. And I don't know if you're seeing that going on in your diocese or what have you, but I'm troubled by that.
I would say I am too. There were certainly moments where I was scandalized by that acquiescence, the way that you describe it. The way that, like I said earlier, where we just sort of punted legitimate moral authority and responsibility to health authorities who have no ethical training and no moral authority within the life of the church, let alone a civic life. To see that happen, to see bishops just forfeit that authority was a scandalous thing to have happen. And then to see the intrusion on, like you say, the way that the liturgy should be practiced or how worship itself should be conducted. You have no authority here. You can give recommendations, fine, but then that's up to the bishop. But it just seemed like the bishops were taking every recommendation to the letter, and in some cases even going quite a bit further with it. It was very worldly recommendations, right? And I can appreciate that if your expertise is merely material in nature, as you know, a medical professional might be, then that's fine. Tell us the information we need to know, and then, you know, answer our questions and perhaps make recommendations based on that. If our clear objective is to preserve the material health of everybody there. But that's not the only consideration when it comes to ethical decisions. Ethics is a metaphysical discipline, right? And so there's a lot more than just material cause that we would want to be considering when we start to ask ethical questions. And I just didn't see those kinds of considerations at play with the health authorities or even with our bishops to some degree. And what I see happening is similar to what you described there, in that we aren't having those follow-up conversations and those debriefing conversations that I think would be important to have. And maybe it's still too early to do that because the dust hasn't fully settled and there's still some concern out there about, you know, what's happening politically or at least health-wise. But I don't think we want to leave this up to mere consequence or resentment or chance for at least a couple reasons. One is that's just not that's a cowardly kind of approach to things in general. I think we need to show a little more fortitude than that. And the other is that we don't know how those consequences are going to play out. We've seen a lot of people leave the church and not come back. And not from just a particular persuasion within the church. We've seen Orthodox people leave the church over this, and, you know, more liberal people leave the church because of this stuff. And I think that that's because of just scandal and polarization and lethargy and apathy in a lot of cases. But until some deliberate outreach and some deliberate willingness to say, hey, we made mistakes here, we got this wrong, I think a lot of people are going to stay away because of the hurts that were inflicted upon them or the scandal that they perceived in that whole process. So I think it's important that we acknowledge the things that we got wrong, be willing to repent and say sorry to whatever degree we were involved in making those decisions, and then as a community try to heal from that. And I haven't seen any indication that that's going to happen anytime soon where I am.
Yeah, well, if nothing else, I mean, I'm certainly making it more of a concerted prayer intention for 2023 that some kind of mechanism, some kind of form emerges. And who knows, maybe this is an instance where the lady rises to the occasion and in spirit of charity, make this pitch, make this plea and petition of our bishops to have that conversation. I want to pivot to another topic which has some similar themes and flavors, and that of course was Pope Francis's visit to Canada. A trip from the Vicar of Christ to your native land is always significant in and of itself, and certainly the specific scope and purpose and impetus for this visit was highly significant and highly consequential. You live in Edmonton, one of the places where the Holy Father visited. Perhaps just speak to that experience. I don't know if you saw, I was going to say in person, or maybe if you were in the crowd in his visit to your city, but just speak a little bit to that and what you observed, I mean, particularly in your own backyard and kind of the impression that you came away with from that experience.
Well, I would say it was a mixed bag. As you say, whenever someone like the Vicar of Christ comes to your hometown, your home diocese, that's an exciting thing. I mean, it's not the first time either. Edmonton is such a remote place relative to the rest of the important places in the world that you'd think that, wow, that's an unlikely thing to have happen. But it has happened twice in my lifetime. John Paul II visited here as well at one point. So that makes you wonder about the significance of the place that you live as well. And is something going on here? Because the Holy Spirit does tend to seem to have residual work in places where the Holy Father has visited. You think of some of the epicenters like in the United States, for example, like Denver. And I'm sure many people would say the same about Toronto, where these places where World Youth Day has taken place, right? That there's been a lot of vitality in the church and in the work and the mission that has been done there since then. So that's my hope for this visit, that it will have that kind of an effect. And I did see a lot of beautiful appreciation from among the faithful and non-faithful people towards the Holy Father. And I think that was an encouraging and inspiring thing. There were also moments from spokespeople from various sides of this particular issue, because obviously he was here to address the legacy and the history of residential schools. And there were gestures and moments, whatever it is that we mean by a reconciliation, but true reconciliation that I saw taking shape that I was really quite encouraged by. At the same time, you know, there's a lot of people who will express their opinion about what happened with residential schools, and it's almost universally negative. They disapprove of what happened, right? And they will very strongly express that disapproval if asked, but otherwise are fairly apathetic towards the whole thing. It seems like unless you're a victim of it, or unless you're somebody who's being painted as the villain by association because of, let's say, your Catholic identity, most people just don't seem to care at all. And I was not old enough when John Paul II came through, but from the stories that I've been told and from the media and the pictures from that event, there was a real interest in what was going on and a real enthusiasm, and huge crowds followed wherever it was that he went. And that wasn't the case with Pope Francis's visit. And you can speculate about why that is, but I think that a general apathy had a lot to do with it. And that's kind of discouraging, because it's easy to have opinions. Opinions are a lazy thing to have, uninformed opinions, right? But if you're unwilling to go deeper than that to understand the true nature of the problem and the various nuances of it, it's very easy to come up with like a real false sense of history. And that can be a really dangerous thing, right? When we want to, if we have a false sense of what happened, and that leads us to believe that certain people and certain groups are merely villainous and in the worst possible estimation, that doesn't end well for society typically, especially if it's inaccurate. So I don't think that we've made strides in the right direction as a society because of that apathy. And then, you know, Pope Francis is a very Petrian character in the sense that he's very sanguine, if you're familiar with the temperaments. And St. Peter himself was extremely sanguine. He was the first to jump out of the boat and say, "Yes, I'm going to come to you, Lord," and then starts to drown because he hadn't really thought this thing through. He was the first that wanted to blurt things out, you know, at the Transfiguration. It's like, you know, we're going to build something here. This is amazing. And you can just get the sense at various intervals that Jesus was just like, you don't get it, Peter, but that's okay. I like your enthusiasm, right? And I think that Pope Francis is very much that temperament. He wants to jump in there. He wants to save the day. He wants to meet with people and have conversations and try to fix things that maybe sometimes he can't really fix. And maybe he doesn't quite understand all the dimensions of it. One thing I really loved about Pope Benedict is that when he wrote about history and Christendom and the various ideas that were mixing together to shape our culture and our society, he really understood the moment in history that he was participating in. I don't get that same sense from Pope Francis, especially from his writings, from his encyclicals. They seem to be inconsistent, incoherent at times, self-contradictory at times, drawing from various schools of thought that are utterly incompatible with each other, and then just trying to make it all work good because it feels right. You know, it's very much sort of an emotive kind of approach to things, and that becomes very inconsistent. And I don't think that serves well in the role that he's in, because he's supposed to be the one who is a unifying force in the church, and he has a vast intellectual tradition that he has to curate that he doesn't seem to really fully grasp. And so in the case of residential schools, you know, a delegation went out to Rome and said, "Hey, this horrible thing happened and we are victims of it." And being the sanguine that he is, he just wants to give everybody a hug and come in and save the day. And I think that more time should have been taken to really understand the issue, the full depth of the issue, the full history of it. And I got the sense that everything was really rushed, really emotional, really sensational. And then he just sort of left as fast as he came, and nothing was really solved as a result.
Feel free to challenge me on this, but I did feel for a papal visit, there was this real flavor and sense of worldliness to it. And what I mean by that is, one, it seemed to me that the prompt or the impetus for the Holy Father to come to Canada in this instance was almost more of an ultimatum than an invitation. Yes, technically, the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops was the group that invited him. That was the formal mechanism. But kind of the larger landscape, I don't want to go so far as to say it was almost the proverbial gun to the head to come, but it was an ultimatum of sorts. I mean, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in its 2015 report called for the Pope in Rome to make a visit to Canada to apologize. And that was notwithstanding the meeting that Pope Benedict had with Aboriginal leaders in 2008 in the Vatican, after which the head of the Indigenous delegation essentially said, this is wonderful. I think we're good here.
Yeah, and this closes that chapter. No more discussion of apologies. He explicitly said that. Yeah.
And that trip to the Vatican in 2008 came on the heels of, over the course of 15 or 20 years, every single religious order, every single diocese that had involvement in residential schools issuing one, if not multiple, apologies. And that context seemed to be lost, to your point, in the Holy Father's visit. And I guess the other, so that's kind of one aspect of worldliness. It just felt there was this strange character, this strange aura that preceded the visit and then followed it as it was taking place. Like, this is just happening on the world's terms, and it was strange and it was awkward, and I think it had an unfortunate effect on the visit. And then in many other ways, I mean, no sooner had the Holy Father set foot in Canada, you were already hearing voices in the media and different public interest groups saying, this isn't enough. I mean, the guy's not visiting every single Canadian province. He's not doing this. He's not doing that. And where's the check? Where's the reparations? And it just seemed like there wasn't good faith at play. So it concerned me that this specific visit in these specific circumstances very much had, to your point, the earlier theme, it had a worldly feel to it. And I agree with you that I 100% think that good fruit will come from the visit. I'm sure at some moment Pope Francis spoke directly to the heart of an Indigenous person, whether a believer or not, a non-Indigenous person, touch that person's heart, and there will be good fruit that comes from that. And who knows how many instances that applies. But it just seemed like a lot got lost. And I think much of that will be attributable to the fact that it was just done on kind of a worldly basis. And I think the capstone to that whole argument, no sooner had the Holy Father set foot in his airplane to cross the Atlantic back home, than in the press scrum, he referred to residential schools as a genocide, which is
a reckless concession.
Which is a careless statement, to say the least. The fruit we could have had from the visit was precluded by this whole approach to the visit being on worldly terms.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And I think, you know, we could extend that to maybe qualify the worldly terms to be very political in nature, right? The sort of the political, the material, the economic aims of certain people who are pursuing, let's say, power or wealth or an agenda, or an ideological agenda especially, were what informed a lot of that, and not clear facts, right? So as you say, it seemed like a closed case after the last delegation went to Rome and met with Pope Benedict. Now, obviously, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was still doing its thing and issuing reports and things like that. But as I mentioned earlier, apathy seems to dominate this issue for most Canadians until the discovery of mass graves, right? One in Kamloops, another in Maryvale, and then just various reports that just kept on coming in from all these places. Well, first of all, it wasn't a mass grave. Even what was claimed wasn't that there was a mass grave in Kamloops. It was that there were unmarked graves in an orchard that coincide with rumors about like just unsubstantiated anecdotal accounts of children being taken out to this orchard and hung from trees for no reason. Just like, really? That's a hard thing to believe. And if that kind of thing did go on, well, that's because that there was a murderous sociopath working there, not because of a systemic problem that existed across Canada. But nonetheless, this report came out, and it was issued with such confidence that children's graves had been discovered. Well, if you know anything about ground-penetrating radar, you would know that all it discovers is disturbed soil. It's not, people have this idea in their minds that this is some sort of an X-ray machine that is scanning bodies and seeing skeletons and coffins and things of that nature. And that's not true at all. Just Google ground penetrating radar images, and all you see are little ripples in the ground that could be anything. It could be, well, this is an orchard. I mean, of course there's going to be disturbances in the ground. This is an agricultural field that was cultivated, right? I mean, there was trees planted there. There was never any confirmation of any bodies, let alone children's bodies. And when further investigation was promised and called for, it never actually took place. Or if it did take place, the truth of the matter was such that they didn't actually want to have it be known by the public. Now, that's purely speculative, but that's a possible explanation for why nobody's bothered to follow up on this at all. In other places where there was claims of mass graves, these were just graveyards that had become undocumented. And if you travel anywhere in rural Canada, as you will know, you can find old abandoned churches all over the place from various ethnic communities and see that there are undocumented graves in these places. Canada was a developing country at this point, in the way that we think of most developing countries today, in some respects. It didn't have the wealth, it didn't have the resources to provide something like a welfare state to ensure that everybody's health was accounted for and to guarantee that people didn't die in the process. People died all the time in the frontier of the 1800s, of 19th century Canada. It was a different world and a different way to live back then. So you can very easily extract any kind of narrative you want out of that. Judged on today's terms, today's economic terms, today's relative moral terms, and kind of make it say whatever you want. And we should be more responsible with details like that. We should be willing to say, well, let's pause the outrage for a second and wait to see if more information emerges. And there were immediate consequences. Churches burned down. A historic church that my friends were married in 15 minutes away from my house was burned to the ground. One of the oldest churches in Alberta, one of the most beautiful, if not the most beautiful church in Alberta, was arsoned. No investigation, no follow-up, no charges, no nothing. There was dozens of churches that suffered this fate, as well as churches graffitied and vandalized and people intimidated. This didn't just go on at 3 a.m. in the morning. There were crowds of people who showed up at mass here in Edmonton, and I'm sure this happened all over the place. There was a Polish community. Polish immigrants didn't have anything to do with residential schools, and yet there was a mob that showed up at the Polish community here, vandalized their Pope St. John Paul II statue outside, and tried to interrupt mass. They entered the building and had a physical confrontation with people. Now, I don't want to minimize the evils that took place in residential schools, but we already knew about those evils. The thing that inspired the most recent events, including what happened at that Polish church, including the arson of multiple churches, was this mass grave story, which was never confirmed and never substantiated. And then of course, that led to the invitation and the renewal of interest in the legacy of residential schools for Pope Francis to come and to apologize.
Yeah, and I think maybe just to wrap this particular segment up, well, in light of the worldly pressures and interests at play here, I mean, it seems to me that the church in Canada, it seems like there's, I was going to say a conscious decision, but there's a clear set of options available to the church. One option is engaging on the issue on those terms, subject to the whims and pressures and interests of the world, or engaging more from the posture that's informed by our own tradition. And I think pointing to the strengths and the beauty of that tradition where we can to help move things forward. I'll be honest. I mean, one thing that I'm grateful for, I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot of beautiful stories about Indigenous-led pilgrimages. These are Catholic pilgrimages in Alberta and in British Columbia. One story I love to reference is Rose Prince from Prince George, British Columbia, who is Indigenous. She attended a residential school, graduated, and then came back as a teacher So an indigenous teacher at a residential school. She died.
Which was extremely common. A lot of the people who worked at residential schools were themselves indigenous. Yeah.
And she died at an early age of tuberculosis. And her gravesite is now associated with Miracles. And there's an annual pilgrimage there. And her cause for beatification or canonization is underway.
And then,
you know, the witnesses of Kateri Tekakwitha and St. Jean de Brébeuf. I've learned so much more about those saints. So it seems to me that we as a church, we do have a conscious choice to make. I mean, which option, which door are we going to go through? Are we going to continue pursuing, quote unquote, truth and reconciliation on the world's terms? Or are we going to draw on tradition, magisterium, the examples of Brébeuf and Tekakwitha and others? Are we going to engage in this issue with an affirmation of everyone is called to know, love, and serve God, including our indigenous brothers and sisters? And that's going to be the lens through which we engage on this issue. And my hope is for 2023 and moving forward that the option is more of the latter. We're going to draw more deeply. We're going to go deeper into the well of the beauty of church tradition and witness and evangelization to move the yardsticks forward here.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think too, you know, to play maybe devil's advocate to that, what I see some people wanting to respond to that would be something like to assert ourselves within our own tradition to try to defend ourselves or to try to steer the conversation based on our own unique, distinctive Catholic teachings and instincts would be to resort back to that colonial attitude that created the problems in the first place. And therefore, we should just let indigenous people be heard and we should be quiet right now. And I appreciate, I think, the sentiment in that to some degree. But what ends up happening and what has happened is that we're not really hearing from indigenous people. Because as you alluded to there, most indigenous people are actually Christian. And so the anti-Christian sentiment that has pervaded this narrative, I don't think that they would sympathize with that very much. Instead, who we're hearing from are large bureaucratic political entities like the Assembly of First Nations, who I don't want to denigrate necessarily, but this is a large political entity who is trying to synthesize the views that are coming from multiple dimensions of the country and with multiple interests that have very little to do or potentially have very little to do with reconciliation or with the good of victims and those who are doing their best to try to make amends. And then also the CBC, federally funded $1 billion budget state media, who doesn't appreciate the nuances of this at all, who is in the habit of just sensationalizing things and taking a particular approach and a particular narrative informed by a particular ideology, which tends to be very secular. So I don't think that that's a better alternative than to risk being accused of being colonial because we're still drawing from our own Catholic tradition.
I think it will serve not just the church well, it'll serve this cause well to deploy the gifted voices within the church who are indigenous and who continue to practice the faith and profess the faith.
Absolutely.
Again, going back to what I have been grateful for to learn from this experience is coming to know people like Father Cristino Bouvet. He was a previous guest on our show. He's doing great youth ministry work in Calgary. He's half indigenous. He comes from Cree ancestry on one side of the family. You know, he's one of a growing number of indigenous Catholics who are engaging very thoughtfully and charitably on this issue. And I'm excited by what they will bring to bear in this cause because up until now, we've almost been led to believe that those type of people didn't exist. And within the midst of this whole debate and this issue, we're learning more that these people do exist. And wow, I mean, they exist in number and they have existed in large numbers for a long time. And I think that's a very constructive contribution to the effort. And that is going to help yield good fruit if we allow that to occupy the driver's seat or a leadership position. We're recording this episode just a few short days after Pope Benedict the 16th passed away. I would just love to hear your thoughts on how you felt when you heard the news and your sense of connection to the late Holy Father and his pontificate.
Yeah, well, my connection is that I became Catholic under his pastoral care. He was the Pope at the time, although I had been leading up to it while John Paul II was still there. And of course, I grew up being familiar with John Paul II because everybody knew who he was as a public figure and a global public figure. But Benedict was the Pope at the time, and I remember watching his election take place at the sort of the infancy of my own Catholic identity. And I grew very appreciative of him as I immersed myself in this new Catholic faith and identity and culture. He is someone whose writings, whose statements, whose comments, whose interviews and general audiences and all the things that he contributed to the life of the church were kind of a treasure to me and sort of a sure thing that you could rely on as you journeyed through this life. He was one who always brought clarity to issues and a measured voice to them. And this is ironic for me because I remember so treasuring moments in which I could hear him speak, right? Like those Light of the World books that Peter Sewald had published or had written and authored with Pope Benedict, where they were these book-like interviews. I remember the first time I read that, where I felt like I was getting a candid perspective from the man, thinking like, oh, this is so unique, and I wish they wouldn't be so uptight about just sharing thoughts and comments on various questions. But the more that has become the status quo in the church, the more I kind of wish we could go back to the days of Benedict, where there was time to come up with a measured response to a question, rather than just blurting out the first thing that comes to your mind and risking confusion, because the amount of authority that comes from that office is massive when it's exercised in a particular way. But it's very easy to confuse people by simply sharing an opinion as that figure that isn't magisterial, and it being mistaken for some sort of a magisterial statement. And Benedict really understood the dangers in that, I think. And so he was very careful to express his thoughts in a way that that showed respect for that office. And even in his writings, there were times where he said, you know, I'm writing this not as the Pope of Rome, but as a theologian and as a disciple of Jesus Christ. And we don't tend to get those kinds of considerations much anymore in a lot of the statements that come out of Rome, unfortunately. So I often respected him I always respected him in the things that he wrote and said, and his very sort of humble, quiet witness and his temperament was someone. I'm a bit melancholic myself, and I could really kind of relate to the way that he thinks and the way that he would sort of struggle to embrace the spotlight, but at the same time want to retreat from it. You could sort of see that dichotomy even written on his face sometimes when he was out in the crowds. Which I could sympathize with. And then, of course, he resigned. And at the time, I remember thinking, well, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he's obviously thought about this. He's prayed about this. And maybe this is what is necessary. Although I've never even heard of a pope resigning before. This seems unprecedented, especially entirely voluntarily like this. I mean, times when this has happened in the past have been under sort of political duress. You know, when these various factions in Rome were competing for the control of the papacy. As far as we could tell, that wasn't going on here, although obviously that kind of thing does go on behind the scenes always, unfortunately. But there didn't seem to be a crisis that he was running away from necessarily. So I just sort of said, okay, maybe this is a good thing and maybe this is necessary. And I also had a naive, maybe I'm playing my cards a little too vividly here, but I would say I always had a very naive trust, or if not naive, at least a trust that that the papacy couldn't be steered in the wrong direction. That we, you know, the cardinals would get together and the Holy Spirit would lead the day, and we would come away with a worthy successor. And in many respects, Pope Francis is a worthy successor. There's a lot, I think, that we can learn from him, from his example and his witness. But I think in general, the church is in worse shape than it was when Benedict resigned. That might be circumstantial. That might be because of the forces external to the church were going to conspire anyways. But I think a lot of it you can trace back to poor governance. And I'm not laying that all at the feet of Pope Francis. I'm saying just, you know, in the church in general. And I think that perhaps just keeping that seat warm for a time would have been better than to resign and allow the things that have happened to have happened. And now he has been retired, or he had been retired for longer than he was actually the Pope, yeah. Which I think calls into question the legitimacy of the claim that this was sort of like an urgent medical thing or something like that, right? I mean, he lived for a long time after that. And even if he couldn't, you know, be the jet-setting Pope that everybody feels that they need to be in the legacy of Pope Francis or of Pope John Paul II, you know, we don't necessarily need that. You know, you could have just, like I said, kept the chair warm, done some writing, at least completed the encyclical that was half done, maybe written a couple more, and exercised whatever governance that he could and delegated to the right kinds of people, then I think we'd be probably in better shape. There'd be less polarization, there'd be less confusion, less trying to interpret seemingly incoherent statements that come out of Rome that are canonical in nature, that are legislative in nature, right? To issue something like Traditionis Custodis, for example, which is quite strong in its language and in its intent, seemingly, but then also to make exceptions which seemingly contradict the legislation. It's just sort of like, well, when those contradictions exist, it's just left up to various factions to try to fight it out. And that's just utterly unhealthy for the church, right? That's, I think, the legacy of his resignation. And I think history's still being written. We're still living within the midst of it. And so how that continues to take shape and what happens in the immediate aftermath of his death will be interesting to watch to some degree for those of us who do find it interesting. But when I heard that he had died, I think probably my immediate feeling was relief for a loved one who had been suffering for a while and just thinking, okay, now pray God that he enters into his eternal reward. And that's a beautiful thing to consider.
Yeah, love and have come to know or regard as a friend. And right. I'll certainly play my cards and say that the friendship, the kinship that I felt for the late Holy Father Pope Benedict was anchored in large part on what he did for the liturgy. I mean, you mentioned just now Traditiones Custodes, the motu proprio from Pope Francis, which overturned or reversed the measures put in place in the 2007 motu proprio from Pope Benedict, Summorum Pontificum, which restored made more available the extraordinary form of the Mass in the Latin form, and which said, look, folks, this has been with us for a long time. It remains sacred. It remains true. It was never abrogated. It was never thrown in the garbage by a previous pope. It's here and it's here to stay. So that was his action from 2007. And I've heard you say many times on your show that you attend a traditional Mass, and I share that. My family and I attend a traditional Latin Mass parish here in the Ottawa area, run by the Fraternity of St. Peter. And the friendship I felt with Pope Benedict was anchored in large part in gratitude for that action.
Yes.
Because my journey of faith has been enriched so much through participation and attendance at the Latin Mass. I would be remiss if I didn't ask the role that the Latin Mass has played in your life and how Benedict made that available and you know how you are still coming to terms, like many of us are, with the fallout from Pope Francis's action. If you could speak to that a little more.
Well, I would say that it's interesting because the claim informed more recent measures was that the allowances given to the extraordinary form, or what was known as the extraordinary form, have created polarization in the church. And the irony of that is that when Summorum Pontificum was issued, I didn't avail myself of it. I didn't really take any interest in the traditional Latin Mass at the time. I just remember thinking, oh, that's good. And subsequent statements about it have indicated that what motivated Benedict in large part was to draw people of a traditionalist persuasion back into the fold and into the bosom of the church. And I think it succeeded in doing that in large part. The Society of St. Pius X just about crossed that threshold. And if it wasn't for what seemed to be a media conspiracy to hatch a scandal right at the moment when that was about to happen, it probably would have happened. I expect that there probably would have been some fractures within the society, but nonetheless, Benedict's papacy was drawing people together. It was reducing polarization. And the reason that my family ran into the Latin Mass and into that community was because of the polarization that has happened after the fact under Pope Francis's papacy, as a result of scandal, sex abuse scandal, crazy accusations, a kind of reluctance to even really do anything about the scandals, revelations that have taken place since then. And I just felt like, where can I find the faithful Catholics that I can be confident in? And simultaneously, there was just some crazy things going on at my parish too, where there was a real sort of renewal of the spirit of Vatican II, which was just not how I wanted to raise my children in the church. And so we found this refuge, and it was there because of Benedict. And it kept us within the bosom of the church, right? I mean, after scandal and moral scandal and sort of intellectual scandal, there are people who start to look over the fence where they think the grass is greener, whether that be maybe in Eastern Orthodoxy, which lots of people have left for, whether that be into schismatic groups, right? And for me, it was like, well, no, I want to stay loyal to, I want to stay within the communion of the church and loyal to the pontiff. And the FSSP offers that to me, where there's a refuge of Orthodox community, teaching, and liturgy, but I'm still Catholic in good standing. And Benedict made that provision available, and now, you know, it's being fractured again, and it's not leading to more unity. It's leading to more polarization. I think it's having the exact opposite effect of what it's claimed to be having. Now, luckily, there are lots of good bishops out there who aren't implementing the full measure of what Traditionis Custodis calls for, and that's true in my archdiocese. And there are a lot of bishops who are sticking their necks out there to protect the faithful, and I think that we need to really show them as much appreciation as we can, because I'm sure it's not easy.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's worth putting a fine point on what you said around the legacy of Benedict's pontificate being seeking creative ways to bring people into the fold. And I like that phrase, returning people to the bosom. One of the biggest legacies, a small but very significant thing, which I thought Pope Benedict did, was the outreach to our Anglican brethren. And Anglicans, yeah, in the United Kingdom who were converting to Catholicism or showing interest. And the mechanism that Pope Benedict put in place to bring those folks in. And it you know, there's a specific apostolic ordinariate structure he put in place, but also allowing those folks to continue celebrating Mass in a liturgy that was pastorally appropriate for them. And I thought, I mean, that doesn't get a lot of attention, but in many ways, it's a companion to Summorum Pontificum and the restoration and protection of the Latin Mass. What he did for our Anglican brethren was amazing, and I thought a real demonstration of a pastor's care and charity and creativity. I think in some respects, the fate, if you will, of Latin Mass in the light of Traditionis Custodes, and the fate of the Anglican ordinariate, I think in some ways they go hand in hand in ways that a lot of people don't realize. But it seems like if certain arguments are made for getting rid of one, I don't know how you leave the other one untouched. And if you were to dispense with both, I think the loss and the tragedy and the scandal for church would be it would be unbearable. It would be really unfortunate. So I think those two things hand in hand, there's mutual enrichment and there's enrichment for the ordinary form. But that's certainly something that I'm grateful for his legacy as well.
In Edmonton during the pandemic, we saw numbers plummet like across the board for church attendance and parishes, and they haven't really recovered from that. But two church communities within the Archdiocese of Edmonton that have flourished and are now packed are the chaplaincy here for the FSSP, the Latin Mass, and then the Anglican Ordinariate community here. And they're not packed with old school traditionalists and former Anglicans. They're packed with Novus Ordo Catholics. They're packed with cradle Catholics and people who would have otherwise probably carried on celebrating the Novus Ordo in their various parishes, but who found refuge in these two communities. So it's kind of ironic that in perhaps a providential way, these pastoral provisions that Benedict put in place have actually served far wider constituency than just those sort of maybe narrow scope of people that they had originally set their sights on. And it's a beautiful expression of, I think, unity and sort of a nucleus within the church where I think a lot of good fruit will be born if they can continue to flourish the way that they are.
I did want to get a little bit in this dialogue to casting our glance towards 2023. And it's always a little tenuous making some predictions, but I'm going to propose a very quick lightning round. I'm going to put a few propositions and predictions on the table, and maybe we can get 30 seconds, 60 seconds of your thought and response. Admittedly, a couple of these are downers, but one of them is really uplifting. So let's just see where they take us. First prediction or proposition for 2023, the church in Germany, which was not always friendly to their native son, Joseph Ratzinger. There's been a lot of discussion around the synodal way taking place in Germany. There's even, I've read and heard more voices talking nervously about the prospect of schism with the church in Germany. Your thoughts on that for what 2023 has in store?
My instincts tell me that nothing is really going to happen there. I don't think something as dramatic as the schism is going to take shape unless bishops from outside of Germany conspire to put pressure on Rome to actually respond in a meaningful way. But I think that Pope Francis's approach to this is dialogue, right? Like that's his instinct. And so he's not going to enforce things. Ironically, he does enforce things in other areas of the church, though. So why he doesn't enforce it here, I'll leave that to speculation. But his approach to Germany, as well as China, seems to be one of dialogue and not asserting himself. And I think it will be up to the German bishops to decide what they do with that. Are they going to hang themselves or just commit some sort of a schismatic act, which I think they've already been approaching. Maybe not, or if other bishops around the world will start to put pressure on that.
It's interesting you trot out that word dialogue as an anecdote over the Christmas break. During the holidays, I try to treat myself to a book from my favorite author, Michael O'Brien. There was a good line from one of his books, which was, "You can't dialogue with dragons. You'll never tame them."
Mm, absolutely.
I think that has some relevance in the context of dialogue with the Germans.
If someone is committed to violence or to your demise or your injury, there's no amount of dialogue. And we learned that in the 20th century, right? We talk about the era of appeasement as the great mistake leading up to World War II, right? And yet we don't seem to have actually learned from it.
So second proposition / prediction for you. Obviously in 2022, big news south of the border was the Supreme Court decision in the Dobbs case, overturning Roe versus Wade. Action now turns to state legislatures to enact policy as they see fit when it comes to abortion or protecting human life. In the aftermath, we talked a little bit already about the attacks we saw on Canadian churches in the wake of the purported discovery of mass graves in British Columbia in 2021. Last year, south of the border, we saw a huge wave of attacks against churches in the United States after the leaked decision in the Dobbs case. I'm curious, so that's one part of my question. The second part is, in 2022, we also saw arguably some of the most significant action from a church discipline perspective out in San Francisco, Archbishop Salvatore Cotaiolone essentially saying to Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, you're not able to present yourself for communion anymore because you are in such a defective state of communion. You're not worthy to come to communion on account of your continued persistent support for pro-choice policy. Those two sides of the coin, attacks on churches and potential discipline from the hierarchy against quote-unquote Catholic elected officials. Over the 2023, what do you see in terms of those two trends?
Well, I don't know if I'd want to make a prediction necessarily, but I would want to set them against the backdrop of history to some degree. And I think that obviously our conversation around residential schools is somewhat relevant to this, because I think the worst things that happened in residential schools were related to the church selling out to the sensibilities of the world, mm-hmm. right? So the federal Canadian government had these policies in place and these ideas about Indigenous people being of a certain way. And they were remote ideas too, right? The John A. McDonald's of the world never came out to Western Canada to actually meet with any of these people or to live with them as the missionaries who did live with them for and lived as them in many respects, to develop their opinions. And so they came up with these opinions and these policies, and then they just sort of enforced them. And when the church committed whatever egregious things that the church did so because it was with the times. It was following the sensibilities of the times. It was progressive. It was not staying true to its timeless teachings and its timeless understanding of the rights of people and human dignity and the inherent divinity that exists in each person. So as we talk about the issue of abortion, you know, a lot of that same language gets used as a way to pressure the church. Get with the times. Follow our lead on this. And insofar as the church does that, she's doing what the Marxists would say is falling on the wrong side of history. There will be generations that move forward here that will be able to accuse the Catholic Church of having not done enough to end the severe injustice of abortion, when in fact, we're the ones doing the most to end it. In the same way that they accuse the Catholic Church of not doing enough to combat fascism and Nazism in Europe in the 20th century, because you can identify a few who did sell out, you know, whether they be bishops or clergy or otherwise. But the vast majority did not have sympathy for the Nazi regime or Mussolini's fascist state or any of that kind of stuff. I guess the lesson to be learned is don't be persuaded by the voices who say, get with the times. The people who were saying that in colonial times or in the pioneer age of Canada are the reason that we have this legacy of residential schools. The people that were saying that in the mid-20th century with all these novel political ideas like fascism and communism are the reason that we have all the atrocities of the 20th century. And it's the reason that we aren't doing a good enough job to coordinate to end the atrocity and the injustice of abortion. So maybe the last thing I'll say about that insofar as like what the bishops should be doing, I think there's never been an age in which there's been so much need for correction and clarity to come from those who have divine moral authority and so much reluctance to actually exercise that authority. And that needs to stop. That's not a legitimate form of dialogue or ecumenism or anything like that. You don't suddenly suspend that apostolic authority just because we're living in an age of ecumenism. You still have to give guidance and direction and discipline when it's necessary.
This last one, I think, is a little more uplifting. I think one of the most exciting things happening in the Church of North America, our neighbors south of the border, the Bishop's Conference, I can't remember the last time I've been as optimistic or excited about a Bishop's Conference initiative. But I'm not sure if you're familiar with the National Eucharistic Revival that the U.S. bishops have been...
I just heard rumors about it, but...
Yeah. So it's kind of this three-year... Essentially, in a nutshell, it's this three-year effort launched last year, which is intended to increase devotion to and understanding of the Eucharist and its central place in our faith. And when I first heard about it, I thought, I mean, man, this is inspiring. This is kind of back to basics. This is... going back to the source and summit of our life, our life together in the common church, and among other things, it seems like this initiative it's going to culminate, or one of the major capstone events will be this National Eucharistic Congress in 2024. I want to be optimistic. I want to be excited about this. It seems like it has real promise, and it seems like something that it's time something whose time has come and arguably is overdue. This type of initiative at this time, is this the kind of thing that's uniquely suited to the moment of 2023? And maybe is there something we up north of the border should learn from or take notice of? But I think I also want to match that with, can a project like this succeed against a backdrop where the traditional form of worship or the traditional rite of worship is being suppressed? And I think those two things work at cross purposes.
Well, I don't think you can go wrong redirecting your attention towards the Lord, right? I mean, in this age of confusion, one of the things that often works against the Catholic Church, and this is a criticism that C.S. Lewis had leveled at Catholicism, is that it's a bit of a jungle. When you have 2,000 years of culture and history all layered on top of each other, It can be hard to identify what's the essential substance of this thing that we think of as Catholicism. And there's all kinds of offshoots and outgrowths that we can latch onto and think, oh, this is what it's all about Fatima, or it's all about some other like particular theological persuasion that only appeared in the 19th or 20th centuries, right? And think this is what Catholicism is all about. And it's like, okay, we've kind of lost the plot a bit, and we need to reorient ourselves back towards the essential. And the essential is obviously Christ himself. And whatever our various persuasions are, if we can all orient ourselves in that way, I'd like to think that grace will prevail, and his direction will start to prevail and to lead to more unity and more healing within the church. So I just don't think you can go wrong with that as long as it's sincere and it prevails, right? If we can actually get sort of a groundswell that helps push this kind of a movement forward, that's great. The other thing I like about it is that you mentioned that this seems to be an initiative of the USCCB. And what's ironic for me is that every time I've been introduced to it, it wasn't coming from bishops conference statements or anything like that. It was always from lay people who were excited about it. And so I see there being kind of a true groundswell of sort of a grassroots dimension to this and a real kind of spontaneous subsidiarity type movement taking shape here. And that for me is very, very encouraging, that it suggests that this really is a movement of the Holy Spirit rather than a bureaucracy or an institution, right? And I think that will be a good thing. How it gets imported to Canada, if it could be, I think would have to be in a similar fashion. It would have to come from the ground up, obviously with the participation and endorsement of clergy and bishops. But I think if it's something that we want, we need to start calling for that and devoting ourselves to it at a very local level, whether that just be through holy hours ourselves, a reemphasis of that in sort of perhaps the homilies and the teachings. And I would say liturgical renewal is an essential ingredient within it as well. You mentioned how is this possible, or what is that going to look like against the backdrop of sort of a suppression of the traditional Mass? And I don't know if I can answer that, but in spite of that suppression, I still see communities like my own flourishing and quite truly bursting at the seams in that, you know, we're shoulder to shoulder at Mass. There's not much room left. And so we're kind of spilling out into the archdiocese now. We're not just sort of this refuge anymore. We're a voice and sort of a force within the archdiocese, I think. And so now I think a lot of these people are going to go out and kind of be missionaries for the full dimension of what it means to celebrate the sacrament of the Eucharist.
Yeah. Well, let's pray that it's not just a prediction for 2023, but it's a purpose. It's a good opportunity to make it our purpose. It reminds me of the old saying, you know, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is today. The best time for Eucharistic revival was 20 years ago. The second best time is today. So maybe we make that our prayer and purpose for 2023. Brian Holdsworth, it's been so great talking with you. You've been very generous with your time. Just before we adjourn, tell our listeners where they can go to learn more from you and benefit from your content.
Yeah, so just go to my website, which is brianholdsworth.ca. And I mean, if you want to follow me on social media, that has all the appropriate links. And that also, I have a community there where people can get kind of exclusive access. For those who want to support financially, they can do it that way, but there's also just free access as well. And then we tend to have some conversations behind the scenes there. And I tend to post more current things that are going on with me and my and the apostolate that way as well. So that's probably the best way to stay tuned in.
Awesome. Thanks so much again for your time. Wishing you and your family and your ministry all the best in 2023.
Thanks, Patrick. Same to you.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts and help us to reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. If you'd like to partner with us in the delivery of this podcast, head on over to our website at crownandcrozier.com and click the heart button in the top right-hand corner to learn more about making a one-time or monthly donation. We're sincerely grateful for you listening in, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship. Until then, God bless.